This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zacharin, assistant editor of the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Tayo Agunbiade, historian and author of Untold Histories of Nigerian Woman, Emerging from the Margins. Tayo dives deep, uncovering many of the key moments in women in Nigeria's history. Tayo covers so much ground in this book that we will likely be unable to get to everything. But if you find this conversation interesting, I recommend you pick up a copy of Tayo's book. Tayo, thanks for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you, Kyla, for inviting me. It's nice to be here.
Of course. You know, this book, I don't want to undersell it. It really is. You there's so much in this book. You really have brought together so much incredible evidence and information. I definitely want to ask about and learn about, you know, how you went through this research process. But before talking about the book, I was just wondering if you could tell us a little about yourself and your background.
Okay, so my name is Tayo Agunbiade, and my background actually is in journalism. Back in the 80s, where I learned how to be a roving reporter and researcher. And so I spent the best part of my years as a journalist and a writer. But now that the kids have left home, as it were, I decided to go back to my first love, which is history, because I am a graduate of history. And I used my research skills to uncover a lot of information across five branches of the archives in Nigeria, as well as the British Library in United Kingdom. So I've spent a great part of my life being a writer. I've written a lot of articles. You know, I've held down a column. I've written so much about women, and I've found that now's the time really to do what I really want to do, which is to write a book about women's experiences, women's voices, women's, things relating to women, just put it out there in the world, because we don't have it. There's not a lot of information about African women, Nigerian women, and where it is written, it's written from a Western perspective. So here's a Nigerian woman, an African woman who has thrown herself deep into the archives to dig up this information and put it out there in the global space.
What was your process like going through the archives and writing the book? Can you talk a little bit about that, those kind of early experiences of piecing the evidence together for the book?
Oh, it was very tedious, Caleb. It's a very tedious process, and it's a very lonely process as well. I traveled by road around Nigeria. I went from the south to the north to the east, to visit some of these places to dig up the information. And because we have our archives really is largely paper based, so you're confronted with stacks of old newspapers, old documents, and some of them are in a very bad state, whereby it's practically falling to pieces in your hands. You really have to handle with care, and a lot of information is missing. So sometimes when you get to some page, maybe a front page news report says continued on page four, you get to page four and you say, oh, it's a big hole, so the information is missing, and so history is being lost in that way. So it was very tedious, because having to travel by road as well, risk to life and limb. I was on the road at night, on the road at during the day, just trying to get to those places and spend a bit of time, up north, then down east in Enugu. But it was also fun and exciting in terms of the information that I found, because sometimes I would let out a, you know, some sort of exclamation in the search room, because I'm excited that, oh, I found this. Oh, I didn't know this happened. Oh, I've seen this bit of information. And sometimes when you say to the ladies there, you know, could you help me get, you know, a newspaper, the West Africa Pilot, for example. And so they go into the storeroom and they can't find the particular year. And then they come out with something else. I said, oh, I couldn't find what you wanted, but I brought this out just in case. And you say, okay. And then you look at it and you see, oh, it contains so much, you know. And I'm like, there's just so much information. As a matter of fact, what I have written, I still have excess information that I haven't put in the book, because it was like, you know, where am I going to draw the line? You know, there's just so much that I just said, okay, let this be the first volume. Other bits of information can be, as you know, a follow-up, as it were.
Yeah, no, that's I think the process of editing out what you're going to look at is can be very difficult. And of course, it's, you know, it can be one of the editing can be one of the hardest things, not just writing. You know, as far as the book is concerned, you cover a lot of ground. You look at over basically 100 years worth of history. And you begin the book, you know, by looking at the creation of the Nigerian Women's Party. So can you talk a little bit about what this party was and why you begin by examining it?
So I decided to use it as the first chapter. The minute I saw it, I knew it would be the first chapter, because I hadn't heard about it before. I was really stunned when I saw the headline that, you know, Lagos women revolt against old Africa. And I'm thinking, in 1944, women were revolting against old Africa. We are still revolting against old Africa. This is in 2019. And I thought, this will be the first chapter, and I need to find out more about this party. Because as a student of history, I wasn't told that women did anything. When we're taught about the nationalist years, the nationalist movements, nobody said, oh, there was a women's party who also spoke up for women's voting rights, etc. You know, so it was deliberate. I knew from day one that this would be my first, would be the first chapter, you know, the opening to the book, as it were. And the Nigerian Women's Party was formed in 1944, as we know. And from the start, it reached across, because it was formed by a group of middle-class women led by Onyeka Abayomi, but she reached across to working-class women. So from day one, it wasn't just a middle-class idea. You know, it was all embracing of all women, you know, to representative of the women in Lagos. And after a while, they decided, you know, they must spread to other parts of the country, you know. And so the party started speaking about some of the issues that are affecting women at the time, you know. And she, during her launch, she actually said that, look, during the launch of the party, she actually said that, look, you know, the interests of women have been sorely neglected. You know, these are her precise words. And she said the men were selfish. You know, they didn't include women in, you know, the municipal councils. Women were not represented there, so women had no voice. And she wanted to, you know, she wanted the party to be a voice for women. And she went as far as, you know, talking about voting rights for women. You know, she wrote an open letter in 1948. She wrote an open letter to the governor of Nigeria, the governor general, John McPherson. And that letter was published in, you know, in the newspapers. And that's why I found it. And in the letter, she also spoke about, you know, the girls' education. You know, we need better schools. You know, she spoke about scholarships. Party spoke about prostitution. You know, they said, look, women, there's a lot of, you know, social laxity and we need to do something about it. You know, she spoke about women's employment and she criticized the men. You know, she criticized Onyeka Abayomi as the leader of the party, criticized the men for not allowing women to be, you know, employed in the civil service. And she did quite a bit of, you know, advocacy for, you know, a lot of these issues that affect women. And, you know, she got a lot of press coverage. Initially, actually, when the party started, some of the newspapers were skeptical. You know, they said, oh, this was just a feminine fancy. But when they started, you know, they had elections, they had an internal election. As the years went by, they were still present and talked and speaking to some of the issues that affect Nigerian women. You know, then the newspapers started taking them much more seriously and said, look, you know, they had editorials written about them, you know, saying, oh, you know, the party has been sustained up to now, and they're speaking to other issues. You know, it's not just a feminine fancy. You know, they have committees, and the committees are, you know, committees for the market, committees for social welfare, committees looking at education, looking at politics, you know, so they had all of that within the party. So it was quite a serious project at the time. And they did, eventually they did get the sort of support and belief that they deserved.
Could you talk about this sort of the general backdrop in which this party was formed, you know, the political rule during the time? What was the current current state like?
The party was formed at a time when only men could vote. In 1922, the principle of elective representation was introduced to Nigeria, and only men were allowed to contest and to vote. And this went on till 1950. And so when this party was set up, it was, you know, seen as a very bold move, because, like I said, they started talking about women should be allowed to vote. Women deserve, if we are paying taxes, we deserve to have a voice, you know, where decisions are being taken. And so it was essentially a male-driven, you know, the electoral process was essentially male-driven. Electoral politics, the entire system was, as a matter of fact, I have written it there that it laid the foundation for what we are still paying for today, because, you know, the political parties were a male project, the electoral system was male driven, and so governance was in the hands of the men, you know, power and authority were in the hands of the men, decision making was in the hands of the men, the municipal councils and the legislative council were all controlled by men. And I should also add that shortly after her party was formed in May 1944, the government had a rethink and then appointed her as a nominee to the Lagos Town Council. So that was one of the things that were, you know, one of the gains, the early gains of the party. And so she was on the council. And not too long afterwards, by 1950, the government decided that, okay, we're going to allow women to participate in municipal elections, you know, to see if they could win seats to the municipal councils. And I believe that this was even done across other British colonies at the time. And so Onyeka Bayomi and one of her colleagues participated in the 1950 municipal elections, you know, though they didn't win, but it was a watershed period for women, you know, to show that, you know, there's no going back. We've gotten this far, and there's no going back to the days of, you know, the entire process being driven and monopolized by men in terms of hierarchy, in terms of the politics. You know, women also have a say in what goes on in Lagos.
Yeah. In addition to, you know, the difficulty that, you know, women face with gaining access to the political system, you also look at education for women in Nigeria under British rule. You know, what was schooling and education like for women versus men in this time?
Well, when education was first introduced, it was targeted at boys, and in the by and by, women, you know, girls were also then included. But the subjects, there were, you know, there was a demarcation in the subjects, and that was based on this ideology the Victorian colonial system was based on. A lot of the ordinances were based on the Victorian ideology that focused mainly on men, you know, and boys and men. And so one of the governors, and I think I opened the chapter with that one of the governors at the time, the Governor General of Nigeria, Sir Graham Thompson, actually said that education is just to get the girls to become good wives and mothers. And so the subjects that were introduced were based on that thinking. And, you know, it was domestic science. The subjects for girls was domestic science, basic arithmetic, reading. But the subjects that will give boys the skills to go out into the working world, those, you know, geometry, carpentry, algebra, you know, those were the subjects that English, you know, mathematics, those were the subjects that were give, that boys were allowed to take. And so girls were, you know, faced this discriminatory practice right from the get-go and were only allowed to do this subjects that will encourage or give them skills to be good wives, cleaning, laundry. You know, so it was all along the line of home management and home economics. And of course, the press at the time also gave credence to this policy because a lot of the editorials which I came across, and I did, you know, quote verbatim a couple of them, where they, you know, speak about girls being in the house as young women and looking after the house, advising their husbands. One editorial even went as far as saying that if a man is not spending his money properly, then it means the woman hasn't done her job properly, you know. So education was based on domestic science. And as a result, a lot of domestic science centers were opened across the country. So, of course, education for girls started in Southern Nigeria, and eventually schools and domestic science centers were opened in Northern Nigeria as well. And so it was the same subjects, you know, home economics. There were school competitions, you know, about, you know, how you could do needlework, you know, craftsmanship, things relating to maternity care, you know, all those sort of things that, you know, revolve around the reproductive role of women. You know, those were the subjects that were being taught in the schools. And then we had organizations that were set up. We, for example, we had the Ladies League of Nigeria, which was run by the wives of the governors. You know, when the governor general is on seat, his wife would be, you know, the driving force behind the Ladies League of Nigeria. And so, you know, they had competitions all over the country, and the subjects were things like needlework, mat making, laundry, you know, all those things that are science. So that was the, you know, the sort of education that girls had for the first, you know, right up to late 1950s, before things began to change.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah, continuing on the theme of education, you look at the West African Students Union, in particular, the WASU ladies. You know, who are the WASU ladies, and why do you devote a chapter to them?
Okay, let me start from what WASU was. WASU was the West Africa Students Union, and it was a body set up in Britain in 1925 by Ladipo Sholanke and Herbert Bankole Bright, who was from Sierra Leone. Sholanke was a Nigerian lawyer. So it was a sort of students hub to look after the issues affecting West African students in Britain. And its motto was self-help, unity and cooperation. But it also served as a platform for anti-colonial agitation, you know, and it also gave ideas and was having meetings and suggestions on to, you know, how to make the colonies better. And they were also part of the work to the march towards independence. As a matter of fact, a lot of the students later went on to become presidents in their various countries. For instance, Kwame Nkrumah was a member. He went on to lead the Gold Coast, as it was known then, now Ghana, to lead, you know, the country to independence. There was Jomo Kenyatta of Kenya. There was Hastings Banda of Malawi, Nnamdi Azikiwe, Nigeria, Obafemi Awolowo, Nigeria. So a lot of them congregated at the WASU. But WASU was essentially a male-driven organization. You know, it was hierarchical, and the men were at the top, and the women were at the lower rungs of the ladder, as it were. And I found out that a lot of the women were involved in the social committees. So they did things relating to fundraising, preparation of food, all those things, those soft areas that, women are normally pushed into. And some of them served as treasurers of a committee and all of that. But I found that in the historiography of WASU itself, there's no mention of any of the women and of what they did, because the organization itself had to rely largely on fundraising. As a matter of fact, the leaders were always out of Britain, in Africa, going traveling around West Africa, traveling around Nigeria, trying to raise funds, to build a hostel, because there were issues relating to accommodation for Black students in UK at the time. So they wanted to build a hostel, and run the hostel. So they went on this fundraising venture, and the women too were part of this fundraising through these, the social committees that they belonged to. But, we didn't get a lot of mention of the women. That's why I devoted a whole chapter to them and called them the WASU ladies. And I found out that not only were they part of the fundraising, they played other roles. And a lot of them also, some of them were, they offered intellectual support, intellectual contributions to the debates of the time, but you wouldn't find it in any of the history. So I thought that they deserve a chapter and to name who they are and what they did and what they said. And it's a way of saying, look, you deserve a place in history as well. So we had the likes of Olabisi Alakija, Aduke Alakija. As a matter of fact, Aduke Alakija was one of two women who served as vice presidents of WASU. There were no other women, just the two of them. And one of them, after Aduke Alakija, the second woman even gave her experience of how she was treated while she was a member of the ESCO. She said, for example, that she would, when they call a meeting, that the men would start to speak about other issues, and it was quite late at night. They're probably hoping she would get up and go. And she said, look, she had already made arrangements with her husband to look after their baby. So she was prepared to sit there until they then decided, well, okay, let's go to the official business of the night, of the day, And so that was her experience. And they were the only two women that sat at the top of WASU. There were no other women except those who were in the social committees and those who were appointed as treasurers. As a matter of fact, a committee was set up to raise money for Abyssinia, Ethiopia, as it was known at the time, Abyssinia, during the invasion by Italy. And they still didn't leave that committee for the women to run. A man was still put in charge. So it goes to show that the organizational views were that, men should be running this show and the women should be at the bottom, and in spite of that, their names are not really included in the historiography of the union. So that's why I decided that they deserve a space, and I've given them their space.
One of the women you also highlight in the book is Alimotu Peleworo. Who was she and why was she so important?
Well, Alimotu Peleworo was what we call a market woman. When we say market woman, what we mean is, because we have open store markets in Nigeria. And so she was, she was a fishmonger actually. But all the various trades, they all come together and form an association. So she was the head of the association. And she was quite vocal during the nationalist years. In 1940, she led a protest against taxation of women. She believed that the women were too poor, they didn't earn much from their little takings every day, and then the colonial government wanted to tax their proceeds. So she led that protest, and according to the documents I found, because I came across a stack of reports, intelligence reports, at the archives in Lagos State, she coined the slogan, no taxation without representation, and she wasn't lettered, but she spoke in the local language Yoruba, and she said, no taxation without representation. And there were a series of meetings back and forth. And so she led that charge that, you have to revoke this ordinance that is calling for taxation of women. And she wrote a lengthy petition with the help of Herbert Macaulay. Of course, all of this is documented in bits and pieces, you know, all over the place. I've seen, you know, if we go online, you will see bits and pieces of what she did. But because I saw the contents of the petition itself, I thought, oh, this is worth reproducing in the book. You know, when the petition was written, her colleagues, about 93 of them, thumbprinted it. You know, so she didn't do this on her own. She had the support of, you know, other women in the markets across Lagos Island and Lagos mainland. And she, you know, so she went down in history as a woman who was constantly trying to improve the lot of working class women. You know, she didn't say, oh, because I'm not able to read and write the English language, that I will stay silent, you know, and absorb, you know, the impacts of some of these policies. So she was well known within the colonial circles. I just don't know if I was to go into the colonial office here in the UK, maybe I would see her name in their documents. I really don't know, because, you know, sometimes what is recorded, it will be recorded from the colonial perspective. They may not necessarily mention her name, but from the Nigerian perspective, you know, the intelligence reports show that she was active. The newspapers also reproduced her what she said. She was interviewed regularly. And when the British MP, Arthur Creech Jones, visited Lagos sometime in 1944 or 1943, she was part of the reception committee that received him in Lagos. And when he returned to Britain, he wrote a letter to thanking her. That letter was printed on the front page of a newspaper. And I saw it and I thought, oh, this is worth reproducing, because it shows that she did gain recognition, you know, even in colonial circles. So Alimatu Pereira, and she has a road named after her, by the way, in Lagos, you know, in some place up market Lagos, Apapa. It's an up market area in Lagos. You know, it goes to show that, you know, what she stood for, what has been appreciated, and it was well recognized. But I still felt that, you know, she needed to be, all these bits and pieces all over the place needed to be put together, you know, in one single chapter for her. I also know that there are not too many photographs of her. You know, I was so determined not to use the photograph of her that is online. And so one fine day I was at the British Library going through the papers, I think it was 1943 or 1944. Suddenly on the front page, I see Alumatu's picture. I was so excited, I let out a scream. And I thought, oh God, I'm in the library, I need to keep quiet. You know, so that, and I said, this is an exclusive photograph. And I went to the library, the licensing department, and asked, could I reproduce this in my book? They said, well, as long as you pay for it, we will send you the copy and you can use it in you know, in your book. So we have the picture of her in the book.
I love those stories, and you're definitely not the first person to tell me that they let out a scream in an archive or almost let out a scream in an archive. It's a great image. This book, you also look at enfranchisement for women and the struggle for the right to vote. Could you talk about how and when enfranchisement occurred for women in Nigeria?
Women achieved franchise in a sort of piecemeal arrangement. Initially, it was, you know, at the local government level, the municipal council levels. Apart from, you know, women being allowed to vote in Lagos Colony, also in Abeokuta province, women were allowed to vote. And so they had voted in 1949, four women were put on the council in Abeokuta province. And one of those women was Funmilayo Ransankuti. But generally speaking, it was the 1951 constitution, MacPherson constitution, which sort of opened the door to women voting at the regional level. Because by then, Nigeria was had been, you know, divided into three regions, and there were regional governments, you know, the North, the West, and the East. And the 1951 Constitution allowed for what was called an electoral college and said women who pay tax, their taxes can are allowed to vote. And this caused some, you know, some anger or some upset, because then it was like, well, how many of them pay taxes? You know, why has it been coined in that way? And this electoral college also was a male-dominated system once again, because it was three levels, the primary, intermediary, and the final. And so if you scale the first level, you then, the intermediary level was really the game changer, because you may pass the first level, but the intermediary level, you are going to be chosen by a group of institutions that were dominated, I mean, the native authorities. You know, the native authorities dominated those, that intermediary level. And you know that it was not likely that they would choose a woman to push her up to the final level, because like I said, there was a three-stage concept. And so Fumilayo Fransokuti, for example, in Abeokuta, she passed the first level but fell at the second intermediary level. And she wrote a letter and she said, look, this is you know, she fell as a result of male chauvinism, you know. And I also found that article, you know, it was published by the West Africa magazine in 1951. So that was that for 1951, and women continued the fight. So there were argument, there were articles being written. A woman called Elizabeth Adekokwe, for instance, wrote an article in 1953. You know, she compared Nigerian women with what had gone on in Britain. She said, if women in, you know, in Britain had got the right to vote in 1928, why can't women in Nigeria also, you know, be allowed to vote? And so we had, you know, women wrote articles, there were columns in the newspapers, you know, women would submit a memorandum talking about, you know, we want the right to vote. And all of this, by the way, went on in southern Nigeria. And, you know, it got to a point whereby in 1948, there was an open letter to, like I think I said this earlier, an open letter was published, and when you can't buy a political party had said, you know, you must give women the franchise. So by 1954, which was the Littleton Constitution was promulgated, it then allowed for voting for women in Eastern Nigeria and Western Nigeria, you know. So for Western Nigeria, Eastern Nigeria, rather, it was 1953. For the Western Nigeria was 1954. So it was, you know, done on a piecemeal basis with all these, you know, caveats attached to it. You know, you must pay tax, or you know, you cannot vote, or you must be, or you can vote but you can't contest, or you can contest, you can't vote. You know, there were all these different caveats attached to it. But eventually, you know, women were allowed to vote in southern Nigeria. So the last battlefront for women's enfranchisement was in northern Nigeria. And that took such a long time. You know, I've written about it. There were two women or three women who were, you know, in the forefront, Gambo Sawaba, Ladi Shehu, and Elizabeth Ivase. You know, they took on the battle. Gambo Sawaba in particular had to go to prison. You know, she went to prison like 16 or 17 times. Because, you know, the government were just dead set. The regional government was just dead set against granting women their political rights and voting rights in northern Nigeria. It was felt that women should be in the house. As a matter of fact, women politicians were referred to as prostitutes, you know, and they were what was called the anti-prostitute raids. So if a woman was found at a political rally, you would be in northern Nigeria, you'd be arrested and charged to court. And this was some of the things that Gambo Sawaba, who belonged to a party called Northern Elements Progressive Union, that was one of the, you know, one of the things that she went through, you know, having to go to prison, having to pay fines, you know, and being brutalized in prison, being brutalized as a woman politician, you know, being assaulted. And all of these things are, you know, documented in the papers. So I pulled them together to put them, you know, in one section for her so that we know what it is she went through. When women were finally granted the vote, it was in Northern Nigeria, it was 1976. So you can see how far gone women in the South were before their sisters in Northern Nigeria were granted enfranchisement. And that was during the local government elections for 1976. And that was how the battle was won. But there's not so much being said about it. I mean, it's not, even though we know that it wasn't, you know, a suffragette movement like we had in the West, men linked arms together and were protesting in the streets and were, you know, smashing windows and accosting politicians, but still the women spoke out in their various pockets. You know, any opportunity there was, it was, when are you giving us our rights? When are women going to be allowed to vote? You know, it was ongoing. It was in the face of the politicians, you know, it was in the face of the political class. And some of the newspapers that were owned by the news, by the politicians also joined in the cry for women's enfranchisement. Though I have to say, I found it cynical on their part. What they were after was they wanted women to be given the right to vote so that the men could vote for them. It wasn't that they wanted the women to to compete with them. So you found out that when women were eventually given the vote in Southern Nigeria, very few of them were able to, you know, participate as candidates on the parties of the main parties that were in existence at the time. So that is why I said is, you know, it was cynical on their part, you know, because the patriarchal view was that, you know, women were not supposed to be in the private, in the public space. They should stay in their roles as mothers and children. But as we've seen, we had a group of very feisty female activists that said, no, you know, we deserve more than this.
After, you know, universal enfranchisement, you know, how did women break the male monopoly on power? You know, who were some of the first women politicians that were acting as representatives?
Well, we had the likes of Wurole Esson, who became a senator during the First Republic. We had Margaret Epo and Janet Mokelu, who both became won elections to the Eastern House of Assembly in the early 60s. But it's just a handful of women, I have to say this. So we can't quite say that we broke the male monopoly. We've tried to, you know, chisel our way in, as it were, but we haven't really succeeded up to today. The data shows us that even in today's Fourth Republic in Nigeria, women are still in a minority. They're just a handful. And it's even gotten worse now because the numbers have been dipping and we're at one of the lowest now, you know, from the last election, 2023, last year. So we haven't quite broken the monopoly. There's still so much resistance to women, you know, being on equal par with men in the legislatures, both at the national and the subnational level. There's been so much resistance, and I write about this in the book as well, whereby, you know, even a bill, legislation that is supposed to sort of adjust this imbalance has not worked because the legislatures are dominated by men, and so once the bill is placed before them, they find reasons to say, oh, it's un-Islamic, oh, it's going to encourage you know, women running us over. It's you have to adjust the title. You have to change the word equality. You know, so they find various reasons to say that, you know, we cannot sit at par with them in the legislature. And so if you look at the landscape of our parliament today, it's male dominated. We have 469 legislators. You know, Nigeria has a bicameral legislative system. In the Senate, we have like 109 senators. We have like four women. In the House of Representatives, we have less than 20 women. The House of Representatives is made up of 360 legislators. We have less than 20. So you can see the gross imbalance. And so women's issues are just put on the back burner. And when they do gather themselves together to say, okay, let us push for legislation that will bring about changes, it gets thrown out. And so we haven't broken the monopoly.
Are there, when you look at the past 40 years, are there, either moments of resistance or people that you find particularly like heartening in terms of their actions or things that are, cause for optimism?
Yes, in the past 40 years, there have been several attempts to change the status quo. You know, women's groups, there's so many women's groups in Nigeria, and sometimes they come together as a coalition. They've taken the government to court, and the courts have ruled in their favor, by the way, but that has not changed anything. We have women who have constantly stood up to speak about this. They have been consistent in their message. We have women who, during their lifetime were human rights lawyers, and they made, women's rights the core of their activities. So the likes of Jade Sola Akande, for instance, a professor of law, she made women's rights the center of her writings, of her agitations, of her activism, So it's not as if to say we haven't tried, women haven't tried. There's Aisha Imam as well, professor and academic, who has written so much about, women's rights. She's an advocate for equality and fairness, but it just hasn't happened. And the evidence of this is that we still have underrepresentation of women in party politics and in our legislators, which is the decision-making organ of the country. So you have women being appointed, as ministers, as commissioners, but at the end of the day, where the decisions are being taken, we are not there. We seem to gain favor more with being appointed, to sit on the state executive council, the federal executive council, even though we're still a minority there. But where decisions are being taken, where debates are being made, and laws are being made, we are simply missing. We are simply missing. There are too few of us to be able to make a change. And all of this also leads to the constitution review process. Women over the years have tried so hard to bring amendments to the constitution, because the part of the problem that we have of underrepresentation is linked directly to the constitution. And I think I devoted a chapter or so to that as well, which I call the 49 wise men, because we had these 49 wise men, which, as far as I can see, is based on a pattern that was introduced in 1922, whereby it is men for men by men. And these 49 wise men were appointed in 1975 as the constitution drafting committee. And so they put together this constitution that was eventually accepted. And it has formed, though we've had series of constitutions in the country, but they haven't moved too far away from the 1975 document that was created. And that has been that has been the negative side for Nigerian women, because even the very wordings in the constitution are not, do not favor women's representation. I'll give a few examples. For instance, political parties, they say, political parties must reflect the national spread. And as a result, you find that the political parties do not look at the gender component of this. Women form half of the population of this country. And that has been the case from the 50s when the census was being conducted. So as I speak now, women form almost half of the population. Yet when the parties are being constituted, the hierarchies of the party, they do not consider the gender content, the gender component. So the parties themselves are filled with the male folk. And the only position that is given to the women is what is known as the woman leader. So you have women leaders at the federal level, the state level, the local government level, the ward levels. That is the only position. And you know, you don't have much of a say in what goes on in the top of the party, where candidates are being nominated, the candidates are being selected for the elections. So, you know, and if only we could get those sections in the constitution amended to, you know, to say, okay, let political parties, let party management, let it reflect, you know, the entire population. You know, it's crafted in such a way that we know that women are given their fair share. Unfortunately, even the constitutional review processes are dominated by men. You know, every session of the National Assembly, every tenure of the National Assembly organizes these constitutional review programs. And you find out that the committees are dominated by men. They would even say, okay, all the female legislators are members of these committees, but we're just a handful, so we don't even make any impact. And the fallout of that was the last constitutional review program that took place in, I think it was 2019 or so, 2020 or 2021. What happened was that the five gender bills that women had put their hopes on that would address some of these imbalances in the country were thrown out, all five of them. You know, and women took to the streets to protest. This was in 2022, actually, 2022, yes. So those five gender bills are still pending as we speak. Though they have promised, the current batch of legislators have promised, oh, we'll look at it, oh, we'll resolve this imbalance. But again, I don't believe it because we have heard them say this before. We know that, you know, they speak to the gallery, as it were, you know, just to, it's all a lot of lip service. Patriarchy rules the day, as it were.
Well, you know, my last question is, you know, with this project and study that you've done, you know, are there other projects that you're looking at or other things that you're considering, you know, having done this, this, you know, this deep dive, ways that you want to either continue this project or move into, you know, a different territory?
Well, thank you for that question, Caleb. Yes, I want to continue trying to work on a second and possibly a third volume because I discovered so much information. For example, I discovered a lot of letters and speeches and columns that women had written across, the different parts of the former British West Africa. But I couldn't put them in this current volume. So I thought maybe I should, you know, edit them and, you know, sort of do, you know, look at women's speeches in English-speaking West Africa. I wouldn't say British, the former British colonies any longer, because I discovered that the wife of one of the presidents of Liberia at the end of World War I actually gave a speech at the Versailles Peace Conference to the French Prime Minister. I found this her speech, though not very long, but you know, significant enough that a woman, an African woman, was, you know, she addressed the French Prime Minister in 1919. So as a result, I thought, okay, I can put all of this stuff together and it could form a second volume. And, you know, I have some material that, you know, women from Sierra Leone had said, women from the Gold Coast had said, you know, so it's a sort of transnational project that I'm looking at. The other thing I'm looking at is that I also found out that women were active during the World War I. You know, if we look go online today and say, okay, women in World War I, we wouldn't see anything that women in British West Africa did or women in English-speaking West Africa did, you know. And I thought women were in the forefront of fundraising in Nigeria, for example. You know, I saw their names and what they did, you know, the events that they held. And I thought, look, this information is just languishing in the newspapers. What is, you know, if it's not put out in books so people can know and reckon with, you know, reckon with what went on in the lives of women in West Africa during World War I and also World War II, you know, women were active as well. So it is worthwhile putting all this material out there, you know, in different book projects. The problem is getting a publisher.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that I am working on more women historical projects so that we fill the gap in knowledge, and women should, West African women also can be part of international history and be part of the global history, you know. So it's, my book can serve as a reference, for instance, and people can actually leverage on it to do further research. I haven't done it all, you know. You can, so it's useful for the, you know, Africa Studies Centers in all the institutions around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's your book is really jam-packed with information. You also have lists and lists and lists of key women. Obviously, you know, you've only we only talked about a few women in particular, but you really in your list have tons of women that, you know, could different biographies could be written about them, and lots of work. I think you're totally right. This could be a fantastic jumping off point. Well, Tayo, thank you so much for being a guest on the New Books Network. The book is Untold Histories of Nigerian Women Emerging from the Margins. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Caleb. I had a great time chatting with you.